Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9 tonight with Hugh Kafam and me, Alan. Coming up on the Joy rooftop this coming Friday and Saturday evenings is the presentation of a dance performance work by Yumi Umiomari and Tony Yap. And Tony Yap joins us in the studio here for Orange Ribbon tonight. Tony was born in Malaysia but now lives in Australia and has become known around the world for his dance artistry. So tonight we'll hear about another side to Tony Yap, his childhood in Malaysia to his present dance works and working with the queer world around him. So we've got another great chat coming up on Orange Ribbon tonight, so stay tuned for the next hour here on Joy 94.9. All the way from Senegal, and that is Wasis Diop with Lena Fiagbi and a track called African Dream, and it's from one of the Putumayo Presents albums. This is Orange Ribbon. You're with Kafam and Hugh and Alan.
Hello, Alan. How are you? Hello, Hugh.
Hello. How are you?
And coming up this coming weekend, Friday night and Saturday night, we have on the rooftop here at Joy 225 Bourke Street a special dance presentation. And one of the performers is Tony Yap, who joins us in the studio. And thanks very much, Tony, for coming in. You're from Malaysia. Whereabouts in Malaysia do you come from?
I'm from Malacca.
Malacca, yes. down the south, as we were saying at the beginning. I guess everybody has in their mind this orange, or whatever it is, ochre-coloured church.
That's right. I only say that it's between Kuala Lumpur and Singapore on the coast. And, you know, it's the longest stretch in the world.
and a dangerous coast as well, digressing. But, no, I'm thinking in terms of shipping.
There are pirates out there, but not on the Malaysian side.
Now, you were born in Malacca.
Yes.
What's your earliest recollection as a child growing up in Malacca? And what sort of family did you grow up in?
Well, the village I was brought up in was actually a very idyllic fishing village. You know, it's one of those villages that we have all the nationalities as our neighbours, Indian, Malays, Chinese. And Malacca, as of course, from the 13th and 14th century, you had
Portuguese, wouldn't it?
Before the Portuguese, we had actually a queen from China, and she brought along 800 craftspeople. And so there was the Malay and the Chinese mix, and the Arab traders came to the port. And then the Portuguese conquered Malacca, and then the Dutch conquered the Portuguese, and then the Dutch handed us to the British, and then the British brought in the Indians and Chinese from China to Malaysia. And so we had this really mixing pot of people. I mean, my grandfather was half Sri Lankan and half Irish, for instance.
Mm. That's a funny mix, isn't it?
Yeah. I know, the Irish part. So that is kind of background I was brought up in Malacca. But this village doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, what happened to it?
Progress.
So it's all just died down due to all these investment into Malaysia?
Yes, you find it, like the coast is being bought up by rich people, maybe. I'm not saying Singaporeans, but, then they've been making this coastal kind of a holiday place. And all that old idyllic places are slowly disappearing. Plus, also, the river.
Do you go back there often?
Very often.
Yeah. How often do you go back to?
Well, this year I've been there twice, for instance. Yeah, it's not by plan. Usually, if I go anywhere in Asia or travel with my art, I stop over in Malaysia.
Right. Yeah. You still have family there, obviously.
I have.
What sort of a family? Talking about family, what sort of a family did you grow up in? Do you have siblings?
I've got 4 brothers and 4 sisters, and I'm the youngest of the lot.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. And earlier you said you were pretty open about mentioning your age. So, how old are you?
I'm 53.
And you're actually quite comfortable with that.
Well, I got no choice.
I know. As most listeners know, my own partner's Singaporean Chinese, and I guess I'm used to the idea of Asians looking very young, but I have to say, you do not look your age.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you're on radio.
Tony and I are very much alike there.
Anyway. I didn't talk about you. I was talking about Tony. So, what about religion in the family? Was it a religious family?
Yes, very
and
religious.
A Muslim family or
no,
a Christian?
No, we brought up Taoist Buddhist.
And what's a Taoist Buddhist?
Yeah, well, that's actually quite confusing. We have a strain of Taoism that came back from China, I think the Song Dynasty. So they practice this mediumship. They have deities of many kinds of gods.
So you can summon up the god and take over the body.
That's right. They go into trance. They walk over fire. They chop their backs with axes, and all that you've seen in you know, shocking Asia, it was there in our village. So that was my upbringing.
Do you use this in your dance?
Oh yes,
I do.
Yeah,
do you really? Do. Yeah, I do. Actually, I actually received a research grant just to go into that area of vocabulary of movement and
interesting
bodywork. Yeah,
I have seen this sort of thing where people enter into a trance.
Yeah,
do you do that when you're, you know?
Well, you know, people understand trance in so many different levels. I think in some religious contexts, when there's a monoculture, they do believe in certain things far back. I think their function of these people into trance is what's interesting. I think, you know, they're usually for healing and for ceremonial situations, and it hasn't changed for many years, centuries, as I say now. But in a sense of art, when we use it in a contemporary context, these body movements, I have to address that, and this is what I'm doing now. You know, what is trance? There are many. I mean, we all go through different levels of trance throughout the day. It is, you know, at one stage you can be totally in control, or at the other end, totally possessed, out of control. In between, you have this range that we have different levels of control. And to me, that understanding of trance is that. I think in dance and in theatre, the deeper you can go into trance, is the better. But then you have to
come out of it.
Well, you have to remember your choreography, you have to remember your text. You know, if you go totally possessed, then, you know,
when you were growing up in Malaysia and going to school, did you have any interest in dancing?
I wished, you know, that we had a culture that encouraged that. But because Malaysia was just got independence in 1956, which was the year I was born, or 57, it was independence, we had a strange education system that shifted from the British education system to a slowly changing Malay education system. So we had everything in English then. Mm. We were studying everything in the English syllables. I mean, we were studying things about, you know, lavender and things that we don't even know what they were. and so we were generation prepared for the West.
So the arts weren't taught at your school?
It was a focus on science and education for the country's progress.
Right.
And I think a lot of artists suffered at that stage. They either had to go overseas, which I know a lot of artists are overseas, or they do some kind of I think Malaysian art has suffered tremendously in a few decades in that era. And now they're reclaiming that, yeah.
Oh, so it's coming back now?
Yeah, because the country is a bit richer now, and they can afford to put money into arts. Like Singapore, for instance, they have lots of money. But then there's a lot more to catch up in Malaysia in that sense, because they still have this tradition, the artists in the villages, etc. But their whole generation that's almost wiped out. You know, and so fortunately, I think there are a lot of artists outside Malaysia. They even have programs like, Malaysian artists overseas.
This is Orange Ribbon. You're with Hugh Allen and Kafum tonight, and we're talking to Tony Yap.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Red Buddha and a track called White Bamboo, and that's from an album called Lapis Thai. It was something I picked up in Hong Kong the other week. This is Orange Ribbon, and you're with Hugh Kafam and Alan. We're talking to Tony Yap. And Tony, you're born in Malaysia, as we've already discovered, and you moved to Australia. Now, you sort of alluded to that indirectly just previously, because you said that you were sort of, as were others, educated for the West. Is that what prompted you ultimately to move out of Malaysia, or were there other reasons why you moved, and why Australia?
Well, also, during that time, I think we had only three universities in Malaysia, not like what it is now. And so this whole generation of us were highly educated, well educated then.
Everyone. Education was there for everyone.
Yes. And then there was already the quota system from the races, and the Malay race had a 65% a quota. So all the other races, including Chinese, will have to fight for the other 35%. However, I think at that time, you either do without tertiary or you go overseas. You know, and I think, you know, it was just almost like a hysteria. Everybody was going overseas, you know, and you're trying to find some money or some ways to go out to do tertiary because you just want to do higher education.
Mm. Was one of the reasons you came here, was it because of your dancing or...?
No. It was totally economical because the Whitlam government had free education then and it was the only choice for me.
So when this was what under the was this under the Colombo plan or was that a different issue?
No, it was a different issue. I think the during the Whitlam government they actually had free education for third world countries.
And how many students came from Malaysia during that time?
I don't really know. I know it's a big number. In Ho Chi Minh and Warrnambool itself, where I was in which is now Deakin Uni, we had 13.
13 in the entire university.
Yes.
But that's in Warrnambool, which is a rather unusual place, I'd have to say, because I'd have to admit that I didn't realise that overseas students were going, at that time, were going to places like Warrnambool.
Well, so was I. I thought Warrnambool was in Melbourne. When I had this big shock when I first came. You know, and I said, well... and then, yeah. And so anyway, it was nice. I liked that country town to this big city. What? I was doing fine arts.
But finance?
Fine arts.
Okay. Fine arts.
Yeah, sorry. Everybody else was
a little bit
finance.
Different from finance to fine arts. What did you know? Presumably because of the education that you had in Malaysia, you would be really reasonably well aware of what the West was like. But did you have any preconceived but false ideas about what Australia was going to be like?
I had no idea. I had no idea. I remember this.
And there was no internet at the time.
No internet at the time, yeah. I wasn't even... I can't even imagine me being Australian, really. It was like a whole wave of things happening automatically. Everybody, you know, get into this boat, and then soon they just end up somewhere. But in Australia, you know, in Melbourne, you find a lot of Malaysians. But in Warrnambool, there's a different story altogether. But in any case, I was definitely very green. I was like a little boy.
How long did it take you to adapt to life here?
I think 2 years.
Two years.
I remember one artwork I did that was a liberating piece of artwork, and it's always been my mark that after 2 years I felt that I could communicate, I could touch someone, or you know, I could talk in terms of a human being rather than just an acquaintance.
And what was that?
What
art piece? What was that?
Oh, it was it's a woodcut of a man exploding almost naked.
And that touched lots of people.
I mean, now if I did again, it would be naked. But at that time, you know, I was a bit bashful. But anyway, it was a yellow piece. It was actually a dancer. I call it the dancer. And I didn't know that I was going to end up being a dancer.
Were those 2 years, those first 2 years then, lonely?
It was a little bit. But then you were very busy, I think, you know, trying to survive, trying to find ways to you know, I remember working in summer holidays and so on. And the other Asian students became a very close-knit kind of community, even though they all did business studies. I was the only fine arts students. So there was, I don't know, I didn't have any recollection of being lonely.
What about racism then, particularly in a country town, and we're talking about what, the early 70s?
76.
Mid 70s.
Yeah.
There's still, Australia still would be not quite as amenable to international people as perhaps it is today.
Yes, that's for sure. But I don't think, I don't recollect racism. In fact, what I recollect is more recent than far back
then. Is it really?
Yep.
Yeah, I was waiting to say, you'd probably find that the country was more friendly than the city.
Absolutely. If anything, it's more the ignorance or the lack of contact with people like us, rather than you know, being racist. You know, they say things at the end like, hey, you know, you're just like one of us, after a while of talking.
Yeah.
And so that's quite nice. You know, it's quite
but it's also frustrating. As an Australian, I find that really exasperating at times, to think that there are people that have to go through that process.
Yeah, but I had a lot of time. Mm. I think as a student, you had a lot of time, and you know, I suppose as an artist, you see things quite differently.
I mean, personally, when I first arrived to Melbourne University, I went to this campus. It was full of, you know, white Caucasian students. I was like totally shocked. Was that for you when you went to campus?
Oh yeah, just to see the garbage man, the white man, was already a shock to me. You know, I mean, any white man you see in Malaysia at that stage were all, you know, higher up in the echelon. You know, none on that level. So.
This is Orin Tribbin, and we're speaking to Tony Up tonight, and it's 29 minutes to 8.
Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Not exactly planned, but that just by coincidence happens to be another track from Senegal off a totally different album, also from the Putumayo World Music albums, and that was a track called Sore from Diogal. This is Orange Ribbon, and we're speaking to Tony Yap. Now, Tony, the gay side, when did you first become aware that there was a gay boy inside?
I think when I was 16, really.
So still in Malaysia then?
Yeah. Yeah, we were all boys school, and I had a few too many best friends, I think.
I think we've all been there. But at the time, given that you were growing up in Malaysia in the, well, we're probably talking about the 60s here, early 70s, whatever, it must have been difficult in a place like Malaysia, particularly as it's primarily a Muslim country.
Yeah, but I didn't even know that I was gay, you know, like until I came to Australia. So, you know, it was really more in the 20s that I really addressed it.
Well, you could have a name for it, because maybe, did you have a name for it?
Everybody end up having a girlfriend, you know, and you think that you eventually will.
Mm.
I remember the first time I slept with a boy, 16, and my classmate, and he was a captain of school, and we end up, you know, having this petting thing, and we stopped, and he said, "Yep, are you homosexual?" I said, "No, I don't think so." I said, "Are you?" He said, "No." I said, "Wow, what a relief!"
And we continued,
yeah, you know. So that was how we actually felt, you know. If it felt natural, it just wasn't.
So how old were you before you actually did anything about your sexuality?
I think mid twenties.
Okay.
when I decided to leave, to stay in Australia, and I think there was a yearning, I suppose.
Where were you living?
I was in Horsham.
Oh. 5. Oh, you got to Horsham from Warrnambool.
Yeah.
So what? This is when you finished university, yeah. Presumably. So what were you doing in Horsham?
Well, I got my first job in Horsham, and then I thought I had one more year visa. I thought I'd just, you know, live as far as a city, from away from the city, and just see how country life is like. And I didn't think I was going to survive there, but I like Horsham. I ended up working in the art gallery for the newspaper, and I just love the country.
And do you still share that passion now today for the country? Do you
absolutely. In fact, you know, they have called me back, the galleries, to open. Their festivals, etc. So I feel like, you know, I'm part of, like a child from the area. I lived there 5 years.
That must feel comforting inside.
Wonderful.
Think after so many years, they want you back.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from the country town as well, so I sort of understand the feeling that you're talking about. But to be out, or starting to come out, in a place like Horsham, for example, you wouldn't exactly have a gay scene in Horsham, for example.
No, but you know, the gallery director was obviously gay, and I was the you know, assistant curator.
That's gay.
But you know, and people ask, you know, do you sleep? I said, no, I don't. Do you? So I don't know. I think it is more an issue being Asian than being gay, maybe, in the country, maybe.
You think? Tell us more about that.
Well, not as a negative issue. It's more like, you know, like, sometimes it's positive. Just for instance, you know, I get invited to judge all the country shows, art section, you know. And Lawrence will say, who is the director? Say, why do they ask you? I'm the director. And I said, I think because I'm more exotic than you are.
Oh, it's like the token Asian guy.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there's plus and minuses, you know, in that sense.
But
so,
is that offensive to you, to think that you might be invited because you're the token Asian or oriental exotic person?
I don't think I was that deep thinking then, you know. I just go when they ask me to go. I was just so busy. I just so busy enjoying the whole experience. Yeah.
So you ultimately moved to Melbourne, and presumably your gay life sort of expanded a little bit further as a result of that. Did it change, or did it change your attitude to being gay at all, or was it really just a gradual coming out process over the subsequent years?
Well, immediately when I came to Melbourne, I met my first partner. Yeah, which after of 16 years, and then we broke up, but then we stayed for a long time together. And in that process, I learned a lot about the whole gay area. I wasn't so much into the scene, so to speak, but I very much wanted to feel part of that community in some ways, and I didn't know how to. And I think yes, it was in the process of really working like in a newspaper, etc. I was working for MCV, etc., and all this, and suddenly working with the people that I really got into the scene.
When did you start dancing?
I started dancing when I came to Melbourne.
That was in the year
1984-85 maybe. Yeah. And I didn't quite start dancing. I was still a graphic designer. I was graphic designer by trade. I worked at La Trobe Uni and then later Melbourne Uni. And I just went for any workshops, and there was a couple of workshops from New York artists, and I just joined. I remember I was the only man and only Asian in the workshop. They were all other women. And that was a time when I didn't even know I was a dancer.
So what brought it out in you?
Actually, before I came to Melbourne, the last exhibition we did in Horsham, I did performance art. I used my body for the first time. And I was
in an artistic way.
Yes. I was hooked. I said, this is my tool, you know, my expressive tool. But I didn't know how to pursue it. So coming to Melbourne was all a whole lot of, you know, educational.
Well, maybe we'll get to talk about how that evolved into what you're doing now with your dance performances. This is Orange Ribbon. We're speaking to Tony Yap.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, this is Orange Ribbon, Joy 94.9's multicultural show with Kafam, Alan and Hugh, and our guest tonight is Tony Yap. Tony, we were talking about your dancing and when you started. Can you just get a little early dance, what did you do?
It's more performance art.
Right.
And then slowly I've learned movement. And then there was an Italian theatre company who actually asked me to join them. And then that was the beginning of a physical theatre life for me for about 5 years. And during that time, Bhutto was very also alive in the Western world.
Bhutto, what's that?
It's a Japanese-style dance that was founded by Hijikata. It's a kind of they call it the dance of the dark side.
Mm.
And it was started in the late 50s, early 60s. It's a movement against the traditional dance, like a lot of Western dance movement as well. But this focus on this grotesque, is the darker side of the human mind. And it had resonance after Hiroshima kind of situation, you know, the whole change. Yeah.
I saw a couple of videos of this dance,
mm-hmm.
and the dancers were covered in white makeup.
Yes.
Why do they do this?
Is it always in white?
It used to be. Now it's changed a lot. In fact, the piece that Yumi Yumare, my other dance partner, who is also on the rooftop in this coming program, when we danced in Tokyo on the Beyond Bhutto Festival in 2002, they said that it was one of the most exciting, remarkable evolution that's happening in not white but tinted skin.
Okay.
So yeah, I think that white was to bring out that sculptural side on the body, because it was a very sculptural form. I may be wrong on this, but there are many other maybe reason.
He looked like something that had come out of a grave in a graveyard, and the way he moved was very like a skeleton, and it was actually quite creepy.
But I think
if I can say that.
Yeah, you could. I mean, I think it is the best side of Bhutto is all his life. Mm. I mean, they always lose quite a lot on video and images like that because it's a visceral kind of a dance. You know, it's not so much this movement or patterning of choreography, but it is something that you actually feel, almost like those trance that you see in us.
They also wear very little clothes.
Yeah.
They're almost naked when they're doing this dance. Is that part of the dance as well?
Not nowadays, but I think, you know, like because of the form, the body is like a theater of the body.
Mm.
So every part tells a story, you know, how you breathe, the sinuous neck or arm, everything, you know, because it becomes a theater itself. The whole body becomes the theater. So yes, I think the nakedness brings this out for sure.
So you do this dance as well. Are you going to be doing it on Friday, Saturday? Or?
I think there will be a moment of nudity, but it won't be like what you saw. It's no longer that form. The Bhutto has evolved. Plus, this is not totally a Bhutto performance that we.
No.
It is Bhutto influence, like all the other influences, like the trans Asian shamanistic dance, etc., that I put into my work. It is not that.
So, how long does your performance take, say, on Friday and Saturday night?
I think it'll be about 20 minutes, but with Yumi's piece, we crisscross it, so it probably a bit. Maybe close to an hour.
And who is this Yumi person?
Yumi Yumari has been my dance partner for a long time. 1996, we've been together in more closer to the Bhutto dance. And we have been doing a series of work called How Could You Even Begin to Understand? And we put it on hold at the moment because we're going through solo works that we're looking deeper into and coming back again. And this is the first time we're coming back, and it'll be on the rooftop. On the first level, and then we're going back deeper again into a duet. This is one of the repertoires I have. Of course, I do solo work as well and also other group collaborations, but Yumi Mare is one of my longest dance partners.
Yeah. It sounds quite spiritual when you say you have to, you know, separate to find yourself and then go deeper.
I think we are looking into that spiritual side, and Bhutto has always got that link to the spiritual. Even Hijikata was talking about the land as a spiritual inspiration. But I think also within ourselves, now that we're growing older and watching parents die, etc., there are questions that come in, and you find in the area of your art how this helps in you finding a meaning, I suppose.
Now that you're getting a little bit older, Tony,
thanks very much.
You told us this. But with your dancing, does your dancing take on a different form the older you get? Does it get harder? Or?
Well, it has changed for sure. I like to think that, a lot of dance masters in the Asian art form, they get better as they go older. In fact, I think some of them don't start until they're just 50 years old. Certain dance form they don't. Yeah, so like the you know the kabuki, the no, etc., you know, where sometimes you just walk from point A and point B, and that's the dance, you know. I think how you walk, the older you are, you know, it can be a whole journey of your whole life from beginning to end. And a young person can't do that.
Mm.
But a young person has this beauty, they have this energy, they have all that, and they have to use that, I suppose. You know, it's a natural state. So I'm trying to find this second life, maybe, in my art. I'm trying to find the depth that I didn't have when I was younger, and I was depending on. And this has been this journey now, in the last year or couple of years, focusing on this area, on this vocabulary,
Where does your dance? You've sort of partly answered the question, but I'm not sure totally. What have you got immediately? I mean, obviously, we've got this rooftop performances coming up Friday and Saturday night. And if you want more information, you go to wspulserooftop.com. That's P-U-L-S-E rooftop.com for more details. But beyond this, what have you got immediately coming up after this and slightly longer term?
Well, I'm doing a performance art with an installation artist in Madura in the Palimpsest Festival, and then I've also got a fellowship, 2-year fellowship from the Dance Board to investigate into this area for my solo work, which is called the Buddha Body Series, and it's a trilogy or triptych, and the first one is called Melancholy, second one is called Rasa, and third one is called Sangyang, and the first one will be in May, Melancholy, with the creative development where I'm working with a video artist, installation artist, and two musicians to put a multimedia form. And I'll be working on a monologue, a movement monologue on that. That is my first big one. In August, this international collaborative work that we've been doing for a couple of years, the Koreans and Indonesians will come and join us in Melbourne, that we just perform in Seoul, and it will be at 45 downstairs called The Buddha of My Body, a palimpsest. So there are, you know, some repeating themes. And then a big thing is that now we're starting a festival in Melaka, my hometown.
Oh, no.
For the first festival, and we're thinking of making it focusing on performance art. So for performance art festival. When I say we, I think, there's the Malacca, a Malaysian group, and then there's the Australian group. So it'd be actually more Victoria, Malacca kind of collaborative work now. But we're starting this really exciting festival that is going to be performance focused.
And you mentioned earlier that, you know, during a break time, that you guys just got a 3-year grant and that there's a bit more focus towards Asian dancers. What brought that about?
Last year, we had someone, we had an artistic director from for the London Festival, the Olympics, London Olympics in 2012.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came and he was talking about the changing societies in England and also in Australia, and how a lot of people who are born overseas or their parents born overseas are left out in a lot of mainstream artistic events and places. The percentage of people going there are small, and Australia has the same problem. And I think knowing this, they're trying to reach out to this audience. Why aren't they coming? You know, why are the same old people coming? Mm. So Asia focus is quite an interesting area for non-Western initiated work, non-Western kind of ideas initiating. There's still a lot of countries in Asia that look to the West as what's contemporary, but now there's a wave of what can be contemporary and still non-Western, and this is what's exciting, I think. Our company has just received a trainer grant, and I think we are the first kind of Asian company in the area, but we focus on collaborative work with Asia, and we focus on multimedia work, multimediums, with dance as a focus. And yep, this is exciting. So I'm new to this, of course. I don't even know how to run a company, but I just know how to dance and, you know, create some work.
And but how big is the company?
Well, the core group is two musicians and visual artists.
That's the one you mentioned earlier.
And
it's a Tony Yap company.
Yeah.
So if you want to Google Tony Yap, you'll find it.
Yeah, well, it's TonyYapCompany.com.
And the dance, the Bhutto is actually spelled as Bhutoh, just in case you want to Google more about the dance. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll have to wind it up there, I think, Tony, because we're starting to run out of time. But the event that you've got immediately coming up is this Friday and Saturday night. It's a performance with yourself and Yumi Umari. Is that right?
Yumi Umari.
Yumi Umari. I'll believe you. And that's, you can get details from Pulse Rooftop, P-U-L-S-E, rooftop.com for more details. At 7:30 this Friday and Saturday night on the Joy Rooftop, 225 Bourke Street in Melbourne. Tony, thank you very much for coming in. We really do appreciate you
coming.
Thanks
for having me.
Thank you very much. You can check Tony's performance here, as I said, on Friday and Saturday night. Thanks to those helping out on reception. Nick, we assume you're there for your help tonight. Coming up next on Joy is Simon and Cook. Whoops, don't know where that came from.
I'll just mention that Jerry's on reception as well.
Yes, Jerry, thank you so much as well.
I think we've just been interrupted by Studio 2. Anyway, that's Orange Ribbon for another week. Thanks for joining us on Orange Ribbon. We'll be back at 7 o'clock next Wednesday for more insights into our GLBT multicultural community here in Australia and around the world. So from all of us here at Orange Ribbon,
good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.